today on Against the Grain, empirical findings abound into the emotional lives and intelligence of animals. I'm CS. We'll present for the first time the full-length interview with Brandon Keim about his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What can animals, non-human animals, do? Do they think and feel, or think and feel anything like we do? Should we think of animal species as an undifferentiated mass, or should animals, not just companion animals, be thought of as individuals with distinct personalities? And how should we think about wild animals and their welfare? Much of Brandon Keim's journalism focuses on the explosion of research into animal intelligence, emotion, and sociality. Brandon's latest book is Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. Today we broadcast for the first time the full program-length version of the interview I conducted with Brandon Keim. When Brandon and I connected, he said this about the book he started out to write.
Originally, when I thought about writing a book, I really wanted to write a book that was just going to be about animal intelligence. And so this is around, you know, back in the early to mid 2010s, I was, I was doing daily science reporting for Wired, and I was writing a lot about animal intelligence, and I've always been really interested in animals. And so that was kind of the book that was originally in my mind's eye. But as I spent more time with it, and as time passed, I just became much more interested in the question of what we do with all of these insights into the minds of other animals. And, you know, I became much more interested in our ethical relationships to animals. I really came to think in a more nuanced way, not on my own, but because I was fortunate to talk to and read so many other wonderful scholars. I really just became more cognizant of the way animals are socially constructed and how, you know, we think about our companion animals very differently than we think about the animals we eat and the animals we use for research, and we think about them differently than animals who are wild. But depending on, you know, where they are in the world and how they fit into our lives, you know, we think about some wild animals very differently than others. And, you know, those sorts of issues became very interesting to me too. And so, you know, what came out of it was a book where I was just asking the question, okay, what does thinking about all animals as persons of a sort mean for how we think about wild animals? Because that's a question that I think, you know, people have thought about what it means to think about, you know, companion animals and animals who are used for food as persons, but wild animals and nature had kind of not received as much attention. So hence Meet the Neighbors.
And by person, when you advocate thinking about all animals as persons, what does the word person mean in this context?
The animal advocates like to say a someone, not a something. And I think that captures it perfectly. And, you know, you can look at it philosophically too. I think Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, said that, you know, a person is an entity who is an end in themselves and not a means to somebody else's end. And I think that's a good definition too, but really a person is a someone, you know, an individual who is conscious and aware and living in the world in the first person, as it were, just like you and I. You know, whether they're a human being or some other animal is really immaterial.
The word neighbor in your book's title, Meet the Neighbors, what do you want that word in that context to evoke?
So there's a couple different things that I want neighbors and neighborliness to mean in this context. And one of them is that, right? Neighborliness. I think being neighborly is really a beautiful ethos. Just the fact that you and your neighbors are living in a shared world together. It's not like your neighbor is living in your world or you are living in their world, but you share one. And really, I think that very much is how I think about other animals and you know, wild animals. And that can mean, you know, the wild animals in your backyard or in an alleyway or in a big park or in a very natural place or in the deep wilderness. In some sense, all animals are our neighbors and we are theirs. And I think there's a spirit of conviviality and mutual respect and tolerance that characterizes being a good neighbor. It doesn't necessarily mean you know your neighbors well all of the time or that you always get along great, because certainly we all don't. But we find ways to get along with each other and often we think affectionately of one another. And that's just kind of how I would like people to think about animals.
How influential has been the notion that humans are different than animals because of the intelligence, the unique intelligence that human beings possess?
That is one of those ideas that is so baked into our intellectual infrastructure that it's almost invisible and we're really not even cognizant of it, even though to a great extent it shapes all of the relationships we have with animals in pretty much any context. And so there's a lot to unpack there, and we could have a whole episode just about the history of how people have thought about other animals and the idea of human exceptionalism and kind of the ways in which it is invoked or constructed to best serve us in the moment or in the most expedient way. But when it comes to the intellectual gap or the supposed intellectual gap between humans and other animals, you know, this is just something that you see coming up again and again and again, not just throughout Western thought, but really just throughout human thought, is that we don't think like them and the way that we think is superior.
And you do trace a lot of the genealogy of thought around this over time, over history. And you bring up Darwin, who pushed against the prevailing views of animal intelligence and ability. In what way?
So just real quick, I'll situate Darwin within a longer intellectual history. One of the things that I had thought sort of going into this interest in animal minds is that, you know, there was kind of a nice linear upwards trajectory where once upon a time people didn't think animals were intelligent at all. And now, thanks to science, we do. And it was a nice tidy story. And really, you know, what I came to appreciate is just that for the last 2,000 years in Western thought, more than that, I'm sure, you know, there's just been this pendulum swinging back and forth between people who say that other animals are intelligent and that we can relate to them in really fundamental ways, and then those people who say that no, they're not intelligent and we're superior to them. And you just see this, you know, the arguments go back and forth across the centuries. And so Darwin comes in at a time where during the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, the pendulum had swung hard towards thinking of other animals as unintelligent, thinking of them as automatons, you know, the philosopher René Descartes, you know, describing them as, you know, basically akin to mechanical toys where you wind them up and they give the illusion of being, you know, of being alive and having minds, but it's all just, you know, so many, you know, little gears and springs turning. And Darwin very much pushed back against that. And he doesn't just say that humans and other animals share common anatomical features, which, you know, was itself a profound, radically reorienting argument. But he says also we share minds. Our minds are also overlap and evolve from those of common ancestors. And, you know, he was not the only person to say those things. But of course, he's Charles Darwin. He is one of the, you know, the intellectual titans of not just his era, but, you know, really Western intellectual history.
Brandon Keim joins us on Against the Grain. He is a journalist specializing in science, nature, and animals. We are talking about his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What do you make of the argument advanced by many thinkers before and after Darwin that animals operate instinctively, as opposed to sort of the rational and contemplative way in which humans operate?
I kind of have a two-part answer to that. One is that, sure, a lot of what animals do is innate, and lately I've had some scientists who've been chastising me anytime I say the word instinct, and they keep on saying, don't say instinct, just say innate. So when I say innate, I mean instinct. Sure, animals do a lot innately, and so do humans. I think we like to think of everything that we do as being, you know, very reflective and contemplative and full of all kinds of insight and inference and, you know, quote unquote, higher order cognition. But really, a lot of the time, like, we're just, you know, running on autopilot too. And then also, animals very often do use reason and inference and insight, you know, and that's not just something we do.
Your book features a lot of stories that push back against a mainstream thinking that encourages us to view animals not as thinking, feeling beings. So let's talk, for example, about a guy named Brad Gates and the task he undertook one day to get a raccoon. This is part of his job. He has a business to get a raccoon out of someone's garage.
Yeah, Brad's a special character. But real quickly, before I talk about Brad, I realized that, you know, earlier on when you asked me about the genesis of this book, there's something I forgot to mention, which was that at the same time as I was, you know, coming to have a deeper awareness of the minds of other animals and, you know, how animals are socially constructed, I also really became aware that when it came to nature and wild animals, the sort of the traditions and concepts that I was socialized to perceive the natural world through, the way that I was taught to think about nature, it didn't include a sense of other animals as intelligent, as individuals, as persons. And of course, nature and the natural world is not just what is found in wilderness places, but also in cities and in backyards, and the relationships we have with animals in those places really constitute a great deal of the relationships we have with nature and with the animals. And so where Brad fits into this is Brad lives in the greater Toronto area, and he's middle-aged now, but when he was a boy, he loved raccoons, and he actually, you know, one of the local pest control companies smoked out a poor mother raccoon from somebody's chimney, and, you know, the babies were left behind. And this is something that used to happen all the time. And so they put an ad in the newspaper saying, hey, anybody want a baby raccoon? It's yours. And Brad responded to that and adopted a baby raccoon and became, you know, dear friends with that raccoon in the special way that you can when you're a young person, and raised that raccoon until she could return to the wild world. But so Brad thought, you know, what I want to do, I want to, you know, work for, you know, wildlife conflict mitigation companies. I'm going to be a wildlife controller. But when he got into the business, it was just brutal, right? Like, he's coming into it because, you know, his heart is full of love for these creatures and the techniques that are being used, you know, trying to gas them out with formaldehyde and, you know, often just killing them because that's easier than anything else. And just, you know, all these ways of treating these animals were really back in the Stone Ages. And Brad said, that's not how I want to do it. And so he really became a pioneer of, you know, humane, ethical ways of dealing with wildlife conflicts in urban areas. And a lot of that is really just about understanding them and making sure they can't get into your home in the first place and knowing their life history so that when you go to solve a problem, you know, you're not causing more for them. So there's this one story Brad really loves where he was called in to get a raccoon out of somebody's garage. And so, you know, and so he goes in and the, you know, the raccoon is kind of up there, you know, I don't know, in a little overhang up in the roof. But so, you know, a big part of what Brad does is trying to figure out how animals are getting into and out of structures. And he cannot figure out how that raccoon got into the garage, right? It is sealed. There's no holes. There's no nothing. And he's perplexed. So anyhow, he goes to, you know, try to capture the raccoon. And the raccoon scampers down a beam, hits the button on the automatic garage door opener, waits for the door to open, and then runs out. And as best as Brad could figure out, that is what the raccoon had been doing every night. She would, you know, somehow she got into the garage in the first place, and then she learned how to work the door opener. So once everybody in the house was asleep, she would open the door, go out into the neighborhood, do her thing, and then come back before everybody woke up, hit the button again, the door would close behind her, and everybody would be none the wiser. So they are such intelligent creatures.
And then there is your discussion of bird nests in this book, Meet the Neighbors, by my guest Brandon Keim. What has been observed about the way birds, certain birds, build nests? And what can be said about the degree to which birds think through and plan nest construction?
So bird nests are one of those things I was raised to think of as, you know, just completely innate. And that is, I mean, that's just how people always think about bird nests. Oh, you know, they just do it. It's there, you know, programmed in their DNA somewhere. They don't really know what they're doing. It's all just coming from inside. And what the research has really been showing, and there's a couple of scientists in particular I'll point to here, Sue Healy over in the UK and Lauren Gillette at the University of Alberta. And what they've been showing is that, yes, there is an innate component to it. Many birds, even if they've never seen other birds build nests, will have some impulse to build something like a nest when the time comes to mate and to have babies. But but they also understand the structural properties of the materials they're using. They will learn by watching one another. They will learn from experience. And, you know, if the nests they're constructing are, you know, if fledglings aren't thriving, they'll change it up and try some different techniques, and they'll get better at it with time. And, you know, so it's really this blend of the, you know, the innate or the instinctive, and the reflective as well. And, you know, something that I didn't mention in Meet the Neighbors, but I've been thinking a lot more about since the book was published, is the aesthetic pleasure a bird takes in a nest, or that animals take in the world, just as we find beauty in the world, but in this context, you know, I think really the state of the science and the evolutionary theory right now points to birds appreciating not only the function of their nests, but their elegance. And then, of course, you know, we do too, right? Bird nests are so beautiful. And sometimes you see them, you know, festooned with, you know, with moss and lichen and these different types of plants. And of course, you know, all of these all of these plants have different functional properties, but it's not necessarily that the bird is thinking of them in that functional way. They can also just be building something they find beautiful or pleasing to the senses.
The book's full title is Meet the Neighbors: Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. My guest is Brandon Keim, the author of the book. Brandon is a journalist whose work appears regularly in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Nautilus, and other publications. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What did Melissa Bateson do to test whether birds, in the case you talk about in your book, starlings, to test whether starlings have feelings?
So what Melissa Bateson was testing, it wasn't only whether starlings have feelings, which is to say, they can feel good or bad for a fleeting moment, but she was testing whether those feelings last, right? And that's the difference between a momentary pain or pleasure and something akin to happiness or sadness, or at least a good or a bad mood. And that's a difficult thing to study in a scientifically rigorous way. And she drew upon this very clever methodological approach, which tests how animals, and it can be done with humans too, react to uncertainty or to ambiguous situations. The operative principle here is that if you're in a good mood, then you kind of respond more optimistically to something that's uncertain. And if you're in a bad mood, you're kind of more pessimistic, right? Is the glass half full or half empty? Are you willing to, make a bet on a 50-50 outcome? The kind of that response to, your cognitive bias, as it's called, is kind of a proxy for your mood. And so with her, she made recordings of starlings crying out an alarm, and then she replayed those recordings to the birds in her lab. And she kind of, the variable she manipulated there is some of those starlings had bathed earlier in the day and others had not. And now the starlings who had bathed earlier in the day, they'd hear this alarm call, and they'd, look up and, okay, there's, nothing to worry about. They'd go back to feeding or whatever it is that they're doing. But, the birds who had not bathed earlier in the day, they'd hear the alarm call. They'd look up, look around. Well, I don't see anything, but they'd keep looking. They'd keep scanning. And then finally, after a while, they would go back to whatever they were doing. So kind of from that, you could infer that, those birds who had bathed were in a good mood. And so that's some really clever science. But also, it's just something I like to think of, anytime you see starlings or any other bird, just bathing in a puddle, right? Or in a little drainage in a park or whatever. I'm always seeing starlings in the park, flapping in the puddles. And it just makes me really, it puts a smile on my face to think that that's something that, is making them feel good.
Self-awareness. How would you define that, and what's been shown about the degree to which animals possess it?
So self-awareness, it's funny. It's one of those things that, it's at once sort of very simple and intuitive, but can also be sort of difficult to pin down, like beauty. But I would define self-awareness as just, it's awareness of the self, that you were you. It's almost the kind of thing, it's really, I think, it's impossible to imagine not being self-aware, because I think some philosophers argue, and I would agree, that to even have sensations at all is to be aware of oneself in some sense. But the way that self-awareness has been kind of constructed in the last century or two, or construed, is in terms of reflective self-awareness, right? So thinking about yourself, being able to picture yourself, imagine yourself in the future, remember yourself in the past, kind of that, that reflection. And the way that this has been measured is through what's called the mirror self-recognition test or the mirror self-awareness test. And, you know, in that a scientist will kind of surreptitiously make a mark, let's say, you know, dab a little bit of red paint on the back of a monkey's head. And then later on, you know, if they look at their reflection in a mirror, and use that to guide their inspection of this, you know, let's say a monkey looks at himself in the mirror. Now he's, you know, looking at the back of his head and he sees, oh goodness, there's a red dot on the back of my head. I didn't know about that. So he reaches up and touches it. Well, then you know that monkey has a self-image of themselves that then they've discovered an incongruity between their mental image of themselves and the self that's in the mirror. And, you know, there's a handful of species who will pass that, you know, certain great apes and some non-human primates, Asian elephants, almost certainly African elephants too, manta rays, if I'm remembering this correctly, maybe cleaner wrasses, magpies, you know, but it's not very many, you know. So you could say, oh, well, you know, that's very few animals are self-aware at all. But a critique of this mirror self-recognition or the reliance upon mirrors is that, you know, well, that makes sense for a species whose conception of themselves is very visual, very sight-oriented, but other sensory modalities are much more important to other species. So you can kind of come up with experimental versions of the test that rather than involving sight, they involve some sort of incongruity, let's say, in odor. And so instead of a mirror self-recognition test, it's a scent self-recognition test. And then you see that, well, it seems like dogs pass that, you know, certain other sort of very nose-reliant species. But then there's this other critique that just says, you know what, okay, these tests, they're identifying, you know, very reflective self-awareness. Like I was saying earlier, you reflect upon yourself. But actually self-awareness, you know, has, you know, it's the layers of an onion, and then that reflective sense of it is sort of one very rarefied and specialized form. But beneath that, you just have this much more fundamental bodily self-awareness, you know, and that is just the sort of the awareness of yourself, your body, in relation to the world. And there's this great experiment that involved rat snakes that was testing this. And so what they did is, you know, the snakes had to go from one side of an enclosure to the other, and there was a partition in the middle of the enclosure. And the partition had a big hole and a little hole. And so before the snakes ate, you know, they would use either the little hole or the big hole. It was fine. They would fit into either one. But after the rat snakes ate a rat, so imagine, of course, kind of the almost like the cartoon version of this, right? You know, the big bulge in the middle of a snake where their most recent meal is. Now those snakes with a big bulge in their middle, they would use the big hole, and they wouldn't do it randomly. They wouldn't try to use the little hole and then go through the big hole if they couldn't fit, but they would just go right for that big hole, right? Because they were aware of the dimensions of their body. And they, you know, they knew they couldn't fit through the small hole anymore. And so that was kind of this, you know, really this clever experimental way of getting at this idea of bodily awareness. And so that is something that is just, you know, ubiquitous in the animal kingdom. It's not just a few extra reflective species here and there, but throughout the animal world, and very much including us too, right? Like, I think we make such a big deal out of reflective self-awareness because it's kind of fancy, and we like to think that's what we're doing all the time. But I would argue that actually so much of our day-to-day awareness in our lives and so much of our day-to-day experience is much more about this just kind of fundamental bodily self-awareness than the fancy reflective forms.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Brandon Keim is my guest, an independent journalist specializing in animals, nature, and science, and we are talking about his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. We talked about personhood and persons as individuals, you know, by definition, and certainly with our companion animals, you know, I think a person who coexists with a dog or a cat would say, yes, my dog or cat has a certain personality. What's a good example of maybe a study or a finding that shows that animals that we don't necessarily associate with having individual personalities, in fact, possess them?
So I would preface the answer to that question with a little bit of a digression or throat clearing, which is that when it comes to companion animals, and especially cats and dogs, it's not like we ask science to show us that they have personality, right? We trust our observations, we trust our intuitions, we trust common sense, really, and say, oh, yeah, of course, you know, these animals do have personality. You can see it right there. But then somehow, really until, you know, the early to mid 2000s, people in general were in this weird intellectual space where on the one hand, they would accept as obvious the presence of personality in some animals, most especially companion animals. But then when it came to the rest of the animal kingdom, it would be like, oh, do they have personality? Oh, what a remarkable thing that, you know, science is showing us that other animals have personality. And I, you know, that's just kind of a window into how the ways we think about animals have kind of always and still are just been kind of a mess, right? And it's so, and I don't say that to discredit the science. You know, I think the science is doing something very important in showing these things in really rigorous ways. But just, you know, the idea that we appeal to science as a source of authority for explaining the subjectivity of certain animals, whereas we don't appeal to science in relation to other animals, is just one of those things that's worth thinking about. But that being said, you know, there's so much research on animal personality, and a lot of it has been, I think, kind of simplistic, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I think the scientists who are doing it would say that too, where they're measuring what are very broad brush aspects of personality. So is an animal bold or shy? Are they, you know, are they curious about new things or very wary of them? You know, broad brush strokes. And there's so much of that research that I don't even know if there's any one single study I would point to, but there is a body of research that's actually come out of a group that was working just up the road here from me in Maine, led by a biologist named Alessio Mortaliti and his collaborators, Allison Brame and others. And so what they were doing, and this was just so brilliant, so they were working in this experimental forest, and a university-owned forest that was just sort of very well characterized, and they could go out and do all these cool experiments. And so what they did is, you know, they would capture pretty much every single small rodent in some big, you know, big area of the forest, one by one by one by one over the course of a spring and summer, give them personality tests, you know, as to their boldness or shyness, you know, a few other traits. And then later over the course of the summer and the autumn, they would try to correlate they would track these animals, you know, they had little ARFID tags in them, and they would make a note of who every animal was so they could identify them individually. And then later, you know, when they were observing how each vole and squirrel was interacting with different types of nuts, and whether they ate them right away or tended to cache them, and if they cached them, where did they do that? And, well, did they remember to come back for them later on or leave them out there in the landscape? And kind of what emerged from all of this was a picture of how the different types of personalities of these rodents shaped the way they interacted with seeds on the landscape, the way they ate them and buried them in the ground, which in turn ought to shape the way that the forest regenerated. And when you have a diversity of personalities, it seems, You also have kind of the fullest forest regeneration process, and that particular conclusion is not written in stone, and there's a great deal that still remains to be learned about it. But the bottom line is that there is a relationship between the personalities of these animals and the way a forest grows, and that connection between the minds of these animals, these unappreciated animals, and the very function of the ecosystem is, I think, just such a beautiful thing.
There is the question of what and how much friendship means to animals. What's been discovered in this regard? Do individual animals form close relationships? And I'm talking about something other than a mating relationship. Close relationships with other individual animals?
This is another subject where I think the observational insights that everyday people have from the, companion animals and domestic animals they've known are hugely valuable because, of course, if you know a dog well, you know a cat well, you know they have relationships. For that matter, goats and cows and pigs, of course, although they don't get a chance to express those relationships and the conditions in which they're forced. But then when it comes to wild animals, there had been really this hesitancy to ascribe friendship to the quality of their relationships with one another. And you can say, oh, well, sure, these two individuals, they spend a lot of time together, they preferentially seek out one another's company. But do we really know that they're doing it because they enjoy each other's company? Or maybe there's actually some other more functional reason, right? It has to do with dominance relationships or protection, or maybe they like the way each other smells or whatever it is, but we don't know that there's genuine affection. And so there's more and more and more studies that, are describing at least rich social networks in animals and really in species you might not expect to see them, right? So some of my favorite research on this comes from studies of garter snakes, very, very common backyard species. I never really thought of them as being social, and yet the research shows that they do have individuals they prefer to spend time with, especially in their winter hibernacula. And so then again, the question is, okay, well, those are social relationships or social patterns, but are they truly friendship? And the scientific jury is still out on that, but it is certainly very plausible to think that it could be friendship. And really, it just makes sense because why, A, why would humans and a few special animals be the only ones of all, of all evolution's children who are capable of having friendships? And also, friendship just makes sense at an evolutionary level, right? Like, there's so much good that comes from social behaviors and social connections, and how better to motivate that than to make you like hanging out with somebody.
Brandon Keim joining me to talk about Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. His last name is spelled K-E-I-M. You write in this book about how the ecologist James Ludwig, in the late 1980s, I think, was charged with the very somber task of euthanizing cormorants that had been poisoned. I think this was on Lake Michigan. After killing, I think, more than a couple dozen cormorant and Caspian tern chicks, he found a baby cormorant. And what happened?
So James, he found this little cormorant baby, and these birds had been poisoned with those environmental pollution, heavy metals, PCBs, that kind of thing. So these poor birds were just being terribly deformed, and in the case of this last cormorant chick he found, the bird's bill basically corkscrewed around, so there was no way she was ever going to be able even to feed herself. And James, he just couldn't kill another bird. Just something in his heart, his aching heart, just couldn't do it anymore. And he said, "You know what? I'm going to take care of this bird. I'm taking her home." And An important bit of context here is that cormorants have just been brutally persecuted throughout, much of the Western world for the last several centuries, but especially so in North America in the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries. And you're talking about birds who used to just have vast populations and were, almost completely exterminated, and a lot of that was because, they were perceived in a morally negative way, right? They're blackbirds, they're taking our food, they're competing with us, they're unpleasant, they smell, all of this stuff. So not only was James Ludwig showing kindness to a baby bird, but kindness to a baby bird of a species who many people have historically despised. And so James takes this bird home, and he names her Cosmos, and Cosmos becomes his friend. They had a couple years together. Cosmos loved to swim in his pool, would sit there on the bench with him while he was reading journals and or scientific articles and journals. And then when James would drive to and fro to legislatures and state houses and schools and what have you to raise awareness about pollution in the Great Lakes and try to get something done about it, he would bring Cosmos with him. There's this one beautiful story he told me where he had gone to a meeting, and I think he had been seeking a grant, and he was rejected, and so he was driving home that night, and he was just despondent, right? In such a sad mood, and Cosmos just put her head on his shoulder, played a little bit with his sideburns, really seemed, to be trying to comfort him. And, I think about, when my dog used to ride in the car with me, that's exactly what she would do, right? If I was down, she'd, be sitting in the back seat and just put her head on my shoulder. So it was just this really lovely story. And, cormorants are actually the animals at the heart of what is one of the most important chapters in the book for me, which is about cormorants and also about this extraordinary colony in Toronto, Canada, which is now home, kind of this spit creative construction rubble turned into a pop-up urban park and home to a colony that's about, 40 to 50,000 cormorants, one of the biggest of its kind in North America. And as this colony was growing larger in the 2000s, there were a lot of people who said, "Oh, well, they're smelly and they're killing some trees," and the number of trees they're killing obviously is just an infinitesimal fraction of the number of trees, felled for human development in the Greater Toronto Area. But of course, that's okay. But we blame cormorants for the trees they kill. And so people said, "You know what? Let's just get rid of them." And there were a few people who fought back. And very importantly, it was not just conservationists who fought back. Really, the region's conservation authority was perfectly happy to let these cormorants be killed, or at least driven out. But it was animal advocates who stepped up. And they said, "No, that's just unfair. We're going to fight this." And what they and the cormorant-loving conservationists who were there ended up accomplishing was the creation of a municipal committee to come up with a solution to the cormorant conflict. And on this committee, there would be people there who were advocating for those cormorants, who were speaking for those cormorants. And, this is something that almost never happens in wildlife management and wildlife conflict resolution. Or really any institutions in society, you do not see animals represented at the table. That's something that really, it's getting beyond just the idea of animal rights into the question of how we incorporate animals and their interests into society and institutions and represent their voices in decisions that are made that shape their lives. And ultimately in Toronto, they figured out that basically they said, "Okay, we're going to set aside this portion of the park for cormorants, and we're going to find ways of, gently encouraging them, to nest over there and not insert in other parts of the park. And we're gonna, encourage them to nest on the ground and not only up in the trees. And really everybody wins. And there's still some people who get grumpy about the fact that cormorants poop too much, or that, the trees in that little part of the park don't have as many leaves on them, and all of that. But by and large, the cormorants are thriving and everybody's happy, and it's all possible because the cormorants, in a sense, had a seat at the table.
So you devote a portion of this book to the wild animal welfare movement. A lot to say here. What is wild animal welfare?
Quite a few advocates and philosophers and thinkers, not even necessarily in the animal advocacy movement, but people whose interests kind of overlap with that, people who are thinking about the welfare and the suffering of animals and, our ethical and moral relationships to them, many of them have become really interested not only in domestic animals, in the welfare of animals who are used for food and who are used for research, but they've also kind of said, well, what about wild animals? We haven't thought about wild animals so much. And I think on the one hand, it's this wonderfully intellectually fertile moment where, you don't see that sort of interest in the subjective experiences of wild animals in kind of the nature traditions most of us are raised with, right? Kind of beauty and biodiversity and wildness kind of gets at it, but in wilderness and transcendence and environmentalism and eco-modernism, all these things, they don't really include a sense of the animals as persons who are experiencing the world. So on the one hand, I think this is it's a really neat intellectual current. On the other hand, kind of a lot of the discourse has really focused on the negative experiences of wild animals, and it is, really framed nature or portrayed nature as this, just this brutal place where suffering dominates and everything is just, disease and injury and predation and early mortality. And it's, and I think it's really, that current has been unfortunate in the way that I think it sort of paints a picture of nature that is so brutal that, you're like, well, goodness, why would we save any of this, right? Let's just pave it all. Things will be better that way. And that itself, I think, is actually an argument you see recurring again and again in the last several centuries, or probably in the last 400 years or so, of Western thinking. It's not brand new. It's just sort of a new spin on an old idea that we don't need to care about the natural world. We don't need to protect the natural world because it's a terrible place. But those aren't the only ideas that, people within the wild animal welfare world have. And, some of the people I talk to in the book with this new group called the Wild Animal Initiative, who are funding scientific research basically into how wild animals experience their lives. And for them, they're just they want to know, do we are the sparrows who live in our cities, or who we share our cities with, are they happy? How would you figure that out scientifically? What is the subjectivity of an octopus like? How does pollution affect not only, the health of fish, but their experience of the world? And I love coming at the question of kind of wild animal experience through that lens. And I think, you could even see a time when we incorporate sort of the well-being of individual animals and the welfare of animals into the way we manage landscapes, right? Like as it is now, like we manage landscapes for all kinds of reasons, for biodiversity or for other environmental values, certainly as, to produce things that are of value to us, all sorts of different value systems and goals get mapped out onto the world around us and are then managed accordingly. But wouldn't it be neat if part of the way we managed the world was to, maximize the happiness of other beings? But in saying that, I don't want to sort of put humanity at the steering wheel all the time, and the relationships we have to the living world aren't always just about managing, nor should they be. A great big part of it is also about stepping back and just respecting the autonomy and the agency of other beings. And let me just add also that one of the things that's sort of frustrating about the way that the wild animal welfare discourse really focuses on the sufferings and the hardships of wild animals is that, that perspective really obscures all of the joys and satisfactions that exist in animal life too, right? Which is something that intuitively you see, but also there's so much research that is illuminating that, right? Just the intrinsic pleasure of flying, the way that warmth feels good or any species appropriate condition feels good, companionship, the exercise of curiosity, all of these things, there is just this extraordinary pulsing web of joy in animal life that exists in the world. And I really think it's worthwhile to think about conservation and the protection of nature through that lens.
Brandon Keim, independent journalist specializing in animals, nature, and science. His work appears regularly in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Nautilus, and other publications. We've been talking about his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World, which recently came out in paperback. Brandon, thank you for your work and for joining me today.
It's such a pleasure, C.S. Thank you for having me here, and thank you for all these wonderful questions.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.